Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Wills. You're listening to the first show that I've had on BBS in quite a while. And the reason is because we've been traveling all over the world, investigating mysteries, strange places, and, well, you know, that sort of thing. Most of the time has been spent, a good deal of the time has been spent down in South America. You'll recall, if you were a listener previously, that one of our last programs was broadcast live from Machu Picchu. Another one was broadcast from Lake Titicaca. And these were programs that we were wanting to involve you with as we were looking into some of the really strange things that we were uncovering on our journey through those regions. Everyone's real familiar with Machu Picchu, and actually, to tell you the truth, we're kind of burnt out on it. Machu Picchu, of course, is a beautiful place, and going there, well, it's just an extraordinary adventure in your life. But once you've gone there 40 or 50 times, well, you know what that would be like. You know all the places, you know all the sights and sounds. Interestingly enough, though, about Machu Picchu, this last trip that we were down there, which was in June, we ran into an old friend of mine. He used to be one of the caretakers for Machu Picchu, and he let me see an entrance that no one outside of the people who work there were allowed to see. It's an entrance that goes down underneath the Machu Picchu complex and goes down through the mountain into a series of temples. These tunnels connect further and go all the way to the bottom down near the river. This is the kind of thing that we just really, really enjoy doing, well, as you can probably tell. And sharing this kind of adventure with you is what we have in mind for this program. But that's not all we're going to do. There is more. The other idea that I have for this show is to share with you some health tips. And, of course, everyone's got health tips, right? But these are a little bit different. If you don't already know it, I'll let you know something else about me aside from the fact that my wife, Kathy, and I go to these extraordinary out-of-the-way places. I'm also a healer. If you go to my website, real simple, jerrywills.com, go to the testimonials page. There are some videos. There's also some letters we've received. And you can read a little bit about what other people have to say about the work that I've done with them. But before you go there, I'll tell you a little bit about myself, which I normally don't talk about myself all that much in this regard. You see, from an early age, I've had the ability to put my hands on a person and see inside of them. This wasn't very well accepted when I was younger, not because I was putting my hands on people, but because of what I was telling them that I saw. I was also psychic in the respect that when I would be around folks, sometimes I could hear, quote-unquote, hear what they were thinking. I could feel what they were feeling. And occasionally I could see things that were just ahead for them. I always saw the energy around folks. I saw the luminous life force field that surrounds each one of us. And it was something that was not really acceptable growing up back in the hills of Kentucky. Instead, it was something to be kept very quiet because, well, what would the neighbors think? So I learned early on to keep this to myself, and I kept it to myself for a great many years, most of my life. Now, because of my wife Kathy and her inspiration and prodding me along, her vision of what I should be doing versus me being confused, not being happy with what I had been doing, which was in electronics. Now I work with people almost every day. And a lot of these folks are in a situation where the doctors can't really explain what's wrong with them, or the doctors really can't help them with the things they have that have gone wrong. Their conditions, sometimes very serious, would frighten any of us. if we were faced with what they have going on in their lives. Some of these folks have suffered pain for years. Physical pain, taking pain pills, using pain patches, having little electrodes attached to the back, along the spine, or along legs, just to get rid of the intense pain that they were feeling. They were always hoping for some kind of relief. Some folks suddenly found themselves coming down with, arthritis or cancer. And what could they do? Follow the doctor's orders, which is what most every one of you listening might consider doing if you were faced with a life-threatening situation like this. But now there's obviously an alternative. Some of these folks have heard about me. And though I'm not 100% effective, and I don't know of anyone really who is, most of the time I'm able to help these folks. I would say the percentages are up 70-80% of the time that there's a favorable response to what I do. And when I finish, I ask them to go back to their doctor, find out if what I've done has worked for them or not. And in most cases, I get calls or emails back, and these folks have told me that, yeah, their situation is finished. There's nothing wrong. In the cases where the folks who have pain have come to see me, well, that's more immediate. That's something that you can tell just by, just by feeling. One person I worked on just a few days ago had pain in their back and in their shoulders. They were, their shoulders were stiff, their back was sore, and this had been going on since an accident about 3 or 4 years previously. After about 15 minutes working on them, I had them bending over, touching the ground, swinging their arms back and forth. They had no pain whatsoever. So this is the other aspect of what I'm going to be doing at this show, is I'm going to be telling you some of the stories of the people that I've worked with. I'm not going to mention any names. If there are names that are going to be involved, you'll find them on my website at jerrywills.com. But I'll tell you what it was like for me as I was working on them, and I'll try to give you some idea how you might be able to avoid the situation that they found themselves in, whether it's with pain or some other malady that has struck someone I've encountered. There are things you can do, and Ben Franklin was right when he said, a stitch in time saves nine, or was that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure? The truth is, there are things you can do now that will help you to remain very healthy for a very long time. Knowing this is vital to your well-being. I believe that knowledge is power. And what I intend to do, whether it's with the Lost World, Ancient Mysteries aspect of the show, or with the health-related aspect of the show, I want to empower you with knowledge, and not knowledge that's just knowledge that I've given to you, but knowledge that you can go and look up, information that you can go and research yourself and find out what some of the details are about the things that you've heard me discuss on this show. Another aspect is going to be your calls. I do work remotely. And most of the time, the remote work that I do is quite effective. I'm pretty well known around most of the world. It's been a long time coming. A lot of folks out there listening might know someone in Hungary or Italy or England or somewhere in Asia. These are all countries that I've worked within to help the people there. Perhaps you need some help. Maybe there's a question you have. Maybe there's an alternative that you're looking for and you don't know where to look, or you don't really know what to ask for, but you know what you don't want. If that's the case, There's a number. All you have to do is pick up the phone, make a call. It's toll free. And I'll do my best to help you. If I don't know the answer, chances are I'll know someone who does. And I'll refer you to that source of information. So as you can see, it's going to be a well-rounded program. We're going to have guests on here periodically. I have a very good friend. His name is, we call him Media Mike. I'm sure he'll be on. Another friend of mine, Robert Stanley, the editor of Unicus Magazine. Another person I know is Bill Foss. And the list goes on and on and on. Some of these people you've heard of, some you may not have heard of. But each one of these individuals, they all have something to share with you. And I'm going to do my best to get them on the program so that they can impart what they know about the various and sundry things that they're involved with so that you might be able to find some happiness, some pleasure, some useful information, something you can take away from the show and actually go, yeah, I'm glad I knew about that. So it's kind of a winging it show this evening, the very first show, and it's not without a few stutters and stammers and a few pauses. So the first thing we're going to go into is returning back to the story at Machu Picchu. Now, the Machu Picchu area is really, really quite ancient. As you might already know, Machu Picchu is connected to the rest of South America through what they call the Inca Roads, the Inca Trails. Most people take at face value that the Inca built Machu Picchu, and of course, why would they be called the Inca Trail if the Inca weren't the ones who actually built it? Well, this is what we were curious to find out. If this culture only existed for about 200 years successfully, how in the world did they traverse the entire length and breadth of South America, building these incredible roadways? And mind you, folks, these aren't just pathways that move through the mountains. We've been on those. These roadways are large. Take a look at the freeway next time you're on it and imagine the freeway is actually constructed. Now, get this. It's actually constructed of cut and placed blocks of granite, smoothed over with curbs, and in some instances, going right up through the mountains, and part of the mountain has been carved away because the angle of ascent or descent, depending on the direction you're going, that angle would have been too steep had they not done so. These roads were made better than the Roman roads in Europe, and they were built long before the Romans ever became a force in the world. How is it that the Inca, who existed between, let's say, 12 and 1500 AD, could have made something so extraordinary that would have taken tens of thousands of laborers, and most likely, because of the length of these roads, maybe hundreds of years, all throughout South America? How is it possible they could have done that? Well, they didn't. Instead, they were just the latest version of human in that area to find them, maintain them, and use them to their own benefit. So who did this? Why did they do it? The Inca didn't have a concept for the wheel. Why would they have roads? And why were some of the roads going through mountainous areas where there were no Inca at all? The reason is simple. Since the Inca didn't do it, we have to look further back in time. And that's what Kathy and I have done. We've gone there. We've walked these roads. We've walked way back into the Andes, further back than most people would ever dare go, trying to find answers. what we discovered is that way back in the mountains, the people there say the ancients built the roads. Who were the ancients? One resource that we have tells us that the oldest known people who were working on these roads were called the Wari. The Wari were people who lived approximately 8,000 years ago. They lived in a place called the Valley of the Ancients, but they weren't the first ones to live there. The first ones to live there, their names, who they were, has been completely forgotten to history. But what they left behind hasn't. And you can see evidence of that in places like Machu Picchu. The evidence they left behind were these immense blocks of granite that were carefully cut, polished, cut and shaped, edges so fine you can't slip a piece of paper between the stone, and in many instances, one aspect of the stone, let's say you had two going together, one face would be convex, and the other would be concave. And they would fit together so tightly that air can't even pass between the stones. High precision. And these stones are 30 feet in the air, one on top of the other, weighing 100 tons. We don't have anything today that will move a stone like that. And Machu Picchu is only one of the many places where you can find this kind of stonework. On one of the trips back into the area we call the Outback, which is far removed from civilization, Kathy and I hiked about 85 miles back through dense jungle where the Amazon rainforest meets the Andes Mountains. This is the eastern slope of the Andes, the slope that's facing the Amazon. During such a journey, we eventually located a lost city, one that no one had ever known of in our culture. A place that was so remote, no one had ever been there. Now, the locals knew about it, so it really wasn't lost. But as far as our society goes, it was completely unheard of, completely unknown. What we found there was startling. After having traveled for many days, passing many different Chechepoya settlements, Chechepoyas were a group of Indians living in the lowlands of the mountains, we discovered a huge stone fortress atop a mountain. Right in that area that's mostly cloudy all the time, we discovered that this must have been occupied at some point by Vikings. And the reason we know this is because of what we found there. Upon the walls into this granite were symbols. They were runes. R-U-N-E-S. And these runes, these runic symbols, were the same ones that you'll find if you go down to your local metaphysical shop and buy some rune stones. These symbols, very nicely and neatly, etched upon the walls. We found other things there as well. The grain bins, they still had grain in them. The corn looked like it had been left there just a few weeks before. Everything was in rather perfect condition. The floors in these places were not dirt. They were large slabs of stone that had been cut and placed. There were a couple of streets winding through this complex, and these streets were also made using cut stones, and the streets had curbs. The roofs of these places were also made of stone, held in place by massive beams, harvested from the jungle down below. When we got back to civilization, we made it a point, because we thought that it was a great find, what a discovery, so we made it a point to go on the radio. We were on the Ian Punnett show, and we started to discuss what we had located there. And we were quickly made fun of, and, well, things kind of turned ugly. But we maintained our belief in what we'd found. I mean, after all, we'd seen this. It wasn't until about 6 months ago, maybe a year, that Kathy was doing some research on another site down in Argentina, found some notes from an archaeologist who had traveled up into Paraguay. And in his notes, he describes something that's called the Viking stronghold. And the reason he knew it was Viking is because he found on the granite of this massive complex runic symbols. So now we had someone else who had seen this, and we didn't feel quite as foolish. There are other things about South America that are just fascinating. Because it's so old, you never know what you might find or where you might find it. And during one of our expeditions, we located something that was quite phenomenal. It's a place called Marcahuasi. Now there's a book out about it. There are websites about it. We even have a video about it. You can go to expeditionstv.com. That's spelled with an X. Expeditionstv.com. And we have a video up there about one of our trips, one of our expeditions to Marcahuasi. Now, this is a place that's 13,000 feet that has no food, no water, no shelter, and it's absolutely the coldest place I've ever been, especially at night. During the day, it's not so bad. You get sunlight. But at night, it's absolutely freezing cold up there. It'll drop 40 degrees, 50 degrees between daylight and night. So you have to be prepared for that. At Marcahuasi, you can see quite a number of phenomenal images. These images are of people's faces and of animals, some of the animals not indigenous to South America. These faces and animals are carved into stone, volcanic rock, and they're carved in such a way so that when the sun comes up on June 21st, the shadow and the light will produce an exact face, an exact image. Daniel Russo had been researching this back the turn of the 20th century. I believe he spent 30 or 40 years there. Dr. Daniel Russo believed that Marcahuasi was so old that no one could ever tell how old it was. He believed that whoever this race of people might have been that had made Marcahuasi, they had left this incredible museum of stone for some extraordinary reason that he was trying to figure out. I don't know that he ever really figured it out. But what he alluded to in his notes and in the notes of others who worked with him suggest that there was a worldwide catastrophe, something that happened 14,000 years ago, which would make it about 12 to 13,000 BC. And this catastrophe wiped people off the face of the earth. The folks who had been able to survive apparently had gathered up treasures, things that were important to bring about the restoration of humanity on this planet, and they had taken these treasures to several different locations worldwide. Apparently, they were able to travel all over the world because people back before this great cataclysm were indeed traveling all over the world as easily as we do today, perhaps even more easily. I don't think they had the airport check-ins that we have. As a matter of fact, there's a stone in Kashmir that is a very large boulder, and the legend about this boulder is that it was brought from the moon, and indeed has been checked, and it is similar in composition to moon rock. Scientists think that it may have been a piece of the moon that broke off and fell to Earth. I kind of doubt it, because it would have left a crater and there wouldn't have been nothing left of it. Anyway, Mark Awasi exists as a result of their attempt, according to Daniel Russo, to memorialize those who had been here before this cataclysm. So who is it that made Mark Awasi? Well, further research by Kathy. She's an amazing researcher. Boy, I'll tell you, she sits there on the computer. She's sitting there now, just researching. Look at her. No, you can't. This is radio. Never mind. She does as well anyway. She isn't dressed for it. Anyway, the thing is, the people who made Mark Awasi, according to this fellow in Argentina, who had been working with Russo, said that they were a Masa culture. They were called Masa. He called them Masma because that's the literal slang for it, I suppose, when you're in South America trying to say something you don't know how to say. But we believe they were Masa. And Russo then traveled all over the world looking for more evidence of this culture, and he found it. He found it in Egypt. He found it in Italy. He found it in Greece. And the more he looked, the more he found. One of the things that I don't believe Russo ever found was something that we discovered on our last trip up there. Because we're always finding things at Mark Awasi. It's just the most incredible place that you can go to if you're really wanting to dig deep into the past and do some research on it. What we discovered, well, actually, what I discovered, about 10 o'clock one night, the full moon was rising over the mountain. And I was out trying to get a picture of a face to see what it would look like in the moonlight. So as I stood there with my video camera, I figured the video camera would get it with the full moon. The moon came up higher and higher and illuminated this face more and more. I pulled the camera out, tried to get a shot, nothing. But I noticed just off to the side of this face that I was trying to videotape, there was another face slowly coming into view because of the light that the moon was casting upon it, upon that stone. And as I watched, within minutes, the face became incredibly clear. It looked like the face of a woman, but a woman from the Far East, let's say. She just didn't look like anyone that I could identify. And as the moon continued to rise, the face became more obvious to the point to where it was startling because of the detail that was there in this face. It was as though I was looking at a woman's face, some exotic, beautiful woman's face, in the moonlight. No color, just the color of the moon, and the color of the pale stone that was carved upon it. So I wondered what it would look like when the moon was overhead. I checked my watch, I checked the time, I calculated how far the moon would travel, and I set my alarm for 3 in the morning. At 3 in the morning, I got up out of my nice, warm, and toasty sleeping bag, put on my Arctic suit, and I walked back down to this area where this face was to be found. There, the face remained. Only now the eyes were closed. With the moon directly overhead, it was as though the woman had closed her eyes. It was the most incredible thing that I found in a long while. How could someone have carved something so exquisitely so that the play of light from the moon would either have the eyes open or closed? Absolutely fantastic. Now, this face was near another grand edifice at Mark Awasi. It's called the Face of Humanity, which is, I don't know, 3 or 4 stories tall. It's quite tall. It may be taller than that. And this face is really easy to see. And if you go to expeditionstv.com and take a look at the video, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's quite large. And you can easily see a young man's face looking off to the west. He'll be looking to the right of your screen. On the left side of this boulder where the face is found, you'll see that there is an old man's face, and it's looking east. All carved from the same huge boulder, the same huge outcropping of stone. On January 21st, the face of the young man is very, very obvious. As the sun comes up, the light plays across this, and it's absolutely perfect in detail, down to the shape of the lips and the eyes and so forth. As the sun is setting at the end of the day, the shadows and light are cast in such a way that that face is no longer as crisp and detailed as it had been in the morning, but now the old man's face, the face is aged, and he's looking down as the sun is sitting on his back. Mark Awasi is full of images like this. Everywhere you look, you find this sort of thing. We make journeys up there periodically. We'll be making some in 2008. And if you're interested to go, we invite folks to come with us. The more eyes you've got, the more you're likely to find. A good example of that is a cave we recently found. And again, it's featured on this video. The video at expeditionstv.com. This cave is down off the side of a cliff, not very easy to get to. But once you get there, what you find is that it's a cave and it's full of bones and skulls and backbones and ribs. It's a burial cave. But we don't know who these people are who are buried there. You see, things don't really decay that rapidly in Mark Awasi because at 13,000 feet, the air is so dry, things are actually petrified. They're just evaporated. They're dehumidified to the point to where they just become bone-like in nature. Indeed, if you're even out there in the sun for a while, you feel like it's cooked your skin. It's like standing under under a fire. Because it's so hot, you have to wear protective clothing, at least some sunscreen and a wide-brimmed hat so you don't get a sunburn on your scalp and sunburn on your face. It's a very, excuse me, it's a very intense region. Other places we've gone to in Peru are equally phenomenal. Just recently, we were living down there. We were living there for 7 months, and during that time, we were working on the next episodes of Expeditions TV. Let me explain something to you about Expeditions TV. Our concept with that was to produce shows about these amazing remote places that we have traveled to, knowing full well that you likely won't be able to make it. Now, Discovery Channel, they usually show the same old thing. So we wanted to show you some things you wouldn't be able to see if you were watching regular TV or one of the regular cable stations. Instead, we put together this show. Well, we went down there and lived for 7 months producing, actually filming. We haven't produced it yet, but filming the footage for the next episode or two. Or three. What we discovered was near Nazca. Now, if you have watched your emails in the past year, you've probably seen, and of course if you're interested in UFOs, you've probably seen this email that's come through, and it's a satellite image of a place in Peru in the desert, and there are all these holes, and all these holes are in a nice straight line, and they go right up a mountain. And we were being told, or it was being suggested in these emails, that this was by extraterrestrials. Because no one could really tell what it was. I mean, you're looking at it, and it certainly does look very odd. Because the holes are in a pretty much straight line, and they're in segments. There's a group of holes, then a space, then a group of holes, then a space. And it's just all the way up the mountain with great attention to detail. So, we want to know what it was. And once we got there, we would videotape it, and we would show it to folks like yourself who would be interested in it. What we discovered is an area that's just absolutely devoid of life. Well, there's a few scruffy little bushes around, but that's about it. Otherwise, it's very hard-packed, dry, dry, volcanic rock-strewn earth. It's so dry there that when you sweat, it's kind of like Phoenix. It evaporates off of you. It doesn't trickle down your nose. Kathy and I walked up the side of the mountain following these holes. We did find them. We found the holes. So as we did this, we're thinking, could this be extraterrestrial? Could these be graves? And grave robbers have emptied these tombs. What is this? We never really came to any clear idea. The holes are about a meter deep and about a meter wide. And they're just burrowed right down into this really, really hard earth. Why in the world would anyone stand in the sun as intense as it is there in the desert of Peru, in this incredibly dry place where there really isn't any water, and make, well, I don't know, maybe there's 3,000, 4,000 holes, all the same size, all the same depth, in nice, neat lines going all the way up a mountain. It rises in height, if I'm not mistaken, from an elevation of about 1,300 feet to an elevation of about, 3,200 feet. So it's about an 1,800-foot vertical ascent. And the mountain is not a gradual ascent. It's up there. We also discovered that where there would be like a natural drainage, like a wash, it must have rained there at some point in time, I suppose, though it hasn't rained in recorded history. But where there was a wash, they had actually piled stones and thrown dirt into it in order to accommodate the need for a certain number of holes wide and a certain number of holes length. We have no idea who did this or why it was done. We asked some of the people around there if they had any idea. The oldest man that we could find told us that no one had ever excavated these holes, and no one knows who did it or why they'd done it. It was a great mystery. We continued our journey through the desert of Peru because Kathy had also found something else in her research. She uses Google Earth for a lot of this. And if you go to Expeditions TV, you'll be able to click on some of the things we have in there, and you might be able to find some links to some of these places using Google Earth. What she found, and what we had already known about, was that before you ever get to Nazca, which is famous because of the Nazca lines, it's south of Lima, about 6.5-7 hours down the Pan American Highway. Well, before you ever got to Nazca, you encounter this area called Palpa. And it's in Palpa that the Japanese released information about 2 years ago. They had found some fantastic new artwork in an area near the Nazca Desert. Well, they didn't find anything that other people didn't already know about, but they just happened to pay the money and get the press release posted out there for everyone to read about. These lines are just fantastic. They're much older than Nazca, because you can see some of the Nazca-style lines in the Palpa Desert, and some of these lines from that same age as the Nazca lines. have kind of obliterated a few of the pulp lines. These are of extraordinary complexity and quite beautiful. While Kathy was searching and looking, she came across something that we'd never seen before any place on Earth. It's a series of geometric shapes. And these geometric shapes were absolutely perfect in detail, just like everything else we find down there that's very, very old. They're intriguing to look at. There are circles and squares and a Star of David kind of shape, and lines intersecting and stones placed very in a periodic way around the edges of circles. We wanted to find this place and see it for ourselves. She found the images on Google Earth. She then set about trying to figure how we could drive our car as close as possible to this place. So we set out one day from Lima. We had a nice condo in Lima, a good place for our base of operation. We drove for about 6 hours, and we finally got to the place that the GPS coordinates matched up to. She had gotten the GPS coordinates for us. Computers in our lap, four-wheel drive going full bore. We turned off the highway into the desert and went down a ravine. And we drove along what would have once been a dry, which is now a dry creek bed. Drove out across the desert, across a few hills, and before you know it, we're at a place that we can't tell heads or tails where we are, but we should be right next to where this phenomenal geoglyph would be. I got out of the car and walked up the side of this very large and steep, rock-strewn, dusty hill. The sun was beating down so hard that I felt as though I were in a microwave. It was just incredible. As soon as I got to the top, it was obvious that we were in the right place. Because there in front of me was a line. As I traced the line with my eyes and went around the hill, I got a little bit higher, and here was this gigantic geoglyph on top of a hill that had long ago been somewhat flattened. The hill was undulating at the top. It had high and low points. There were slight cracks in its surface. Perhaps this was from earthquakes. There was no trace of water at all. As I walked across the ground, my feet were crunching. The desert patina. What had happened is that over the ages, any residual moisture in the air had been absorbed by the ground, and the sun baked it. And as it baked it, it created a varnish on all the stones, including the sand. And as I walked across parts of the sand, my feet would crunch through as though I were walking on crackers. And I left footprints behind. When I got closer to where the geoglyph was at, I walked on the lines so as not to disturb the desert. Kathy followed within a few moments. I called her on the radio. She came up, followed my footsteps, walked on the lines. We walked around the perimeter of this, videotaping the whole time. At one point, we couldn't figure out where north was because it was that time of day. The sun's directly overhead. We had driven and gotten slightly turned around. The GPS was back in the car. So were the computers. But she had three compasses. Actually, she had two, and I had one compass on my wristwatch. It's a Sun 2 wristwatch with a built-in compass, a little wrist computer of sorts. They're pretty dandy to have when you're out on expeditions. It tells you all kinds of stuff, things about the temperature and the barometric pressure, and more importantly than time, it tells you direction. I asked Kathy to get a bearing so we'd know what direction these lines were in. She whips out one compass, and it's moving side to side, and it isn't getting a reading at all. takes out the other compass. It's saying first north is to our left, then north is to our right, and it's just moving around kind of crazy. So I said, oh, you know, those damn cheap compasses, I'll try this expensive wristwatch thing here. I tried it, and what I discovered is that it had screwed up my wristwatch compass so bad that it didn't work at all. I had to bring it back to the States to get it fixed. As soon as we got away from the lines, later in the afternoon, her compass started working properly again. What we ended up discovering is that as we walked around the edge of this fantastic geoglyph, the needle was always pointing towards the center of the geoglyph. It seemed to always be orienting in that direction. We did get video. The video camera did work just fine. We took several pictures. Our next stop, when we left there, was the airport. We hired a plane and we flew around and around and around this geoglyph, videotaping and taking as many pictures as we could. I think we must have taken 100 pictures and at least an hour of videotape. When we got back to Lima, we put all this into the computer, worked our way through it, and you can see what Kathy discovered. If you go to expeditionstv.com and click on the link that asks the question, what is this? Yeah, folks, there are a lot of strange things out there, and we've only scratched the surface. We're going to switch gears here for a second, because we're in the last, I'd say probably the last 10 minutes of our show this evening. A couple of the things that I wanted to cover before I went off air tonight. I want to let you know that, first of all, some upcoming things. Kathy and I, we just returned from being in Nashville, Tampa, Orlando, and New York. We did some shows in each one of those, and shows. We appeared there, not at any organized event, really. You see, I travel around the country working with people. We've been doing that a lot more lately. We had an event in Nashville called the Gateway Experience, where we go into more detail about some of the things I've talked with you this evening about regarding mysteries, lost cities, and ancient things in Peru. And then the other part of the evening in Nashville was spent with me speaking about healing, health modalities, and then having, a few hours where I'm working on folks. People in the audience that have something wrong, they come up, I work on them, they're okay, they go sit down. That event was in Nashville, and this was last Sunday, which would be the 11th of November. We have another event coming up December 8th, and that's why I'm telling you all this. Because on December 8th, we're going to be in Tallahassee, Florida. If you go to jerrywills.com, take a look at the link. It says the Gateway Experience. Click that link, and it'll tell you all about what we're going to be doing and where we're going to be doing it. And we invite you to tell your friends, or just come by yourself. A lot of very interesting things happen during an event such as this. Aside from the fact you either are meeting new friends or seeing old ones, one of the things that was just fabulous this last seminar we hosted was a fellow, and I believe he told me he was about 45 years old. He said he was a hellraiser when he was a kid, got into all kinds of things. One of the things he must have gotten into caused him to need his both of his knees to be replaced and a hip to be replaced. He had a brace in his spine. He had not been out of pain since he was 13 years old. Every day, lots of pain. He came up, he was one of the last people I worked on. And when he came up, he told me these things. So, undaunted, I just went to work doing what I know how to do. I regenerate tissue and restore the life force energy into broken body parts. Within 10 minutes, I had him doing knee bends and twisting on his sore hips. He had no pain whatsoever. And the rest of the evening, he kept giving me the thumbs up and told me later he hadn't felt that good since he was 13 years old. That's when all this apparently had happened to him. I didn't know that going into it. I figured he'd just been in a wreck or something. So here's a fellow that for the better part of 30 years had been in constant pain, who instantly had no pain whatsoever. It was quite an event for him, and I was very grateful to have had a chance to work with him. It was astonishing to see the look on his face. And of course, the people who were there watching, well, I think it was quite an event for them to see as well. The whole point of this that I do, aside, of course, from the obvious of, you know, trying to do something good, something to help someone, is to provide a sense of hope. So before I close out the show this evening, that's what I want to do for you. I want you to know that there's a reason to have hope. Things may look bad, but they're not as bad as they seem. If you're in pain, if you need help, go to my website and let me know. Show up at one of these events. We're going to be going all across the country. I'll do my best to help you, either in a private session or in front of, you know, 120 pair of blue eyes. Quick math on that would be 60 people. And perhaps I can do something to help you as well. Now, as we continue with this show in the weeks and months ahead, it's going to be broadcast to you live. You're listening live. So if I stumble and fall, you'll hear things around me clattering. You'll be able to listen live from wherever we are. You'll probably, if you tune in, you'll be listening to me from Tallahassee, because I'll be broadcasting a show from the Tallahassee area. After that, who knows? Maybe it's Memphis, maybe it's Austin, Texas, maybe it's your hometown. If you think that this is something you'd like to be involved in to help us organize an event such as this in your area, you need to contact Kathy. You can reach her at 602-604-0212. And right now, the BBS radio website is under construction, but we'll have the information there as well. Otherwise, you can just go to jerrywills.com and click on the Gateway Experience. All the information, contact information is there. Information about what we're doing is there. But we'll be bringing you the show live. And as we travel across country, I'm sure we'll have interesting folks that you'll enjoy listening to. I'm going to try and find folks in these areas that we're at to be on the program with me. We have an hour-long show, and I'm sure these folks will have a good time as well as you. So, I suppose we're getting pretty close to the closing of the show. Got about 2.5 minutes to go here. So I'm going to say goodnight to everyone for now. Wishing you all the best. And the next show will be even more interesting. It won't just be me talking, I'm sure. But at least now you have an idea of what my vision for this program can be and what we're going to do our best to bring to you. And, of course, as we travel to South America, that's no limitation for us either. We have a full set of communication skills and equipment. We'll broadcast live from wherever we are, including a lost city. I'm sure a satellite phone will link right up to the servers at BBS Radio. So thanks, everyone. I appreciate the fact that you've taken a few minutes out of your life to listen this evening. And stay tuned. I'm sure there's more good information to follow this show. Otherwise, tune in again next week. Same bat time, same bat channel, here on BBS Radio. I'm Jerry Wills. You're listening to my program. It's called Channel U. And I'll speak with you again. I'll be visiting you at home next week. Until then, good night for now.